pitchfork,
pushing all those sex crops up from the dirty ground.
How'd you get that fat lip? Old war wound. X up around morons.
Are we in?
This is Miller's Crossing.
We're in. Welcome to
Coen Brothers Brothers.
Comedy Bang Bang. No, sorry. Wait. What? You were right.
I was right.
The thing you said.
Why are you? This is not a bit. Coen Brothers Brothers. I'm Abe Epperson.
I'm Michael Swaim.
We are the brothers of the Coen Brothers.
We're just two mining brothers.
Just two Miller's brothers.
It's just two. Oh my God. The show's just two brothers.
Just two brothers.
It's just two brothers.
It's just two brothers. So we're coming back after Raising Arizona. And of course, in 1990, they went to the Miller's Crossing, which is a fantastic film. I mean, that's what this show is going to be about mainly, is that we love the Coen Brothers. And
ha ha ha, my friend. Really? Okay, cuz I want to say this is the first
brothers,
one we've hit.
Not cuz.
That true. True dat, bruv.
True, bruv.
Bruv. But I appreciated it a lot more when I put more effort into watching it for the purposes of this podcast and really sussed through the symbolism and the structure and the Yojimbo-ness of it all. But I never considered this a jewel in their crown. It's not my favorite one to watch, which on the Coen Brothers scale doesn't mean it's not engaging. It's incredibly engaging the whole time.
You're saying subpar Coen Brothers. Good movie, subpar Coen Brothers.
I feel that way, and I'm wondering if you do or don't.
I don't. I think it's okay. A fucking jewel in their crown.
Right, okay.
It's such a... I mean, there's so many of them, obviously. Right. But this one is so important to me because it's, in a way... To me, Blood Simple was like they're on deck and they knocked it out of the park somehow still. And the batter up was Raising Arizona. This is them working within an institution where they're now like, here's the third thing. So we worked as independent filmmakers, one. Two, we made our own artistic auteur movie. Three, we're working in the studio system and we're still fucking killing it. So it's like the three types of movies that they actually make, this is the third one, and they still fucking kill it. Because it's a transparent film, and by transparent, I mean like, you don't feel the footprint as much of the Coen Brothers
right.
as versus like Raising Arizona
Lebowski,
or Hudsucker.
Hudsucker, yeah. You're like, Coen Brothers' style is blasting you in the face.
Yeah.
And those are the ones I like.
Those are my favorite.
Yeah.
But this is them showing they can do a studio film right out of the gate. And they've done several studio films.
And they did, and it's a story genre, not so much these days, but certainly in that era, mafia movie. It's like,
yeah.
Okay,
it's a gangster film.
Let's buckle down and do a thing that is a time-honored tradition and show we can do it well, and
right.
It's subdued.
Right.
Visually subdued, I mean. The plot is bonkers. But
it's kind of Big Lebowski-ian.
It's incredibly complex or Arrested Development-esque. because I'll admit, the first couple times I saw it, I didn't fully understand every little wrinkle of the plan. And now I do.
Yeah.
Which is a good segue into our first spectra. We always analyze these films through three spectra. And the first will be diegesis. What happened in the movie? What's the movie about? We've already alluded to the fact that it's about mobsters.
And just to signpost, the next thing we'll talk about after that is how do you do that?
No, pedagogy.
Pedagogy.
And then how
where
do
we
do
talk
that?
About symbolism.
Exactly.
And then how do you do that if there's any outstanding things that we haven't talked about regarding the filmmaking itself?
Or just mind-blowing factoids, yeah.
Yeah.
This is technically, diverging, but it's so interesting what you said about the 1, 2, 3, because it just makes me realize then Barton Fink is a movie about the studio system, but the movie itself is totally not a studio movie.
Right. Which will be next episode.
Right, so we can't talk about it, but the pattern's there. So this is a mob movie. It's loosely based on a Dashiell Hammett novel called Red Harvest.
Yeah,
and they love Dashiell Hammett.
And it was a flop.
Detectives. This flopped.
The budget was $14 million, and the box office was $5
million. We gave him the high hat.
They gave him the high hat.
The box office let him go.
John Polito, playing Johnny Casper, would say.
Yeah, so who do we got in here?
Gabriel Byrne as Tom Regan.
Mm-hmm.
Marcia Gay Harden as Verna. Albert Finney. Leo. John Turturro. in perhaps his best role, Bernie, in my opinion, as Bernie.
Better than his role in Oh Brother?
Topic
don't,
for another
don't
day.
Make me, don't Great. Make me have them fight.
Don't yeah. make me choose my Totoros.
Yeah. It's just this one, like, that one's a comedy and he kills it. Right. This one is like a heart-wrenching performance that only a few actors have really touched.
Much like Blood Simple, if you listen to that episode, there is a sequence in this that became the legendary sequence, and we'll get to it. And it's Totoro just owning everyone.
J.E. Freeman as Eddie Dane and Steve Buscemi as Mink.
Buscemi. I think it's Buscemi.
You're probably right.
As Mink. Yeah. All right. So to give a broad overview, what it's going to be is a multi-layered thing. Okay. So there's the Irish mob and the Italian mob, and they're warring. Yes. And we follow the leaders of those two mobs and their consigliaries, basically. Yeah. And it's just a game. It's, if you're familiar with Yojimbo, which is the classic Kurosawa movie where a dude rolls into town, sees that there's two factions, and plays them against each other, and then blows out of town. It's a slight permutation on that.
That was a samurai film. Fistful of Dollars is a Western. This is the noir version of that.
Yes. And of course, it's not identical because Gabriel Byrne's character, Tommy. Who's our central character, has a vested interest in one side. But you, the audience, are not sure until the very end what his intentions were. Right. And it sort of becomes revealed that he always had everything in hand, and it was a crazy sequence of strategies.
And typically, in both the case of Yojimbo and Fistful, I think our protagonists, like how they update that story in this one, is that those stories are about tales of how badass your protagonist is at effectively, like, constitution checks and diplomacy checks throughout the fucking film. And it's about survival. Like, the main goal is to survive, which is also Tommy's goal.
Right.
But he's, as you'll probably talk about, and even from the get-go, an immensely flawed human being. And the way they, I think, updated is that he doesn't even know why he needs to survive.
Right. And we'll get into it real deep. And I think the pedagogy spectrum of this film is off the charts good. And
so act two.
I guess where it falls down to me, doesn't fall down, but I'm just saying the diegesis is basically just a very well-woven sequence of maneuvers.
Yeah.
And like Yojimbo or Fistful. So the maneuvers are this, and we probably can't go into every tiny detail because there's a lot of like double crossing and whatnot. But Gabriel Byrne, Tommy, is a very loyal consigliere to Albert Finney, who's the head of the Irish mob. And the Irish mob is waning while the Italian mob is waxing in
with
power.
Johnny. So you got Leo versus Johnny and
Johnny Casper, who's most Tommy. Often referred to as Casper.
Casper, yeah. And you got Tommy, who's the right hand man of Leo, and over the span of the movie, flips.
Yeah. And if you know Godfather, he's his consigliere, meaning he's his friend who advises him and is just always there hanging out.
He's also in a relationship with Verna, who is the, I guess, fiance by the end
by
of
act
the film
two, she,
of off, Leo. Yeah. So he's literally having sex with the woman that his main, the guy he starts with, Leo.
Ah, so here's the rub, right? Yeah. And this is the initial predicament our guy finds himself in is, and here's the tiny technical detail that starts all the events. Johnny Casper has a fixed fight that he always wins at. He does it once a month and it's his routine.
Yeah.
Well, the way a fixed fight works is, if you understand gambling, the more people who know about it, the less the fix gives you obscene profits because it dilutes the odds to the point where, oh, if everyone knows it's fixed, then the bet is no longer a long shot.
It's not lucrative.
It's no longer lucrative. He feels that his fixed fights that he personally fixed, so he knows they're fixed, he's winning, but he should be winning more. And his suspicion is one of the bookies involved is selling the information that the fight is fixed to schmoes or friends, you know, being like, hey, I got an angle. This gangster fixed this fight. You can bet on it too.
Yeah.
And he's saying, no, that's disrespectful to my fix. I put the fix in. That's my property as a mob boss. So
everyone's got an uncle.
Here's the thing. Without any proof, he assumes Bernie Birnbaum, who is a bookie in town, played by John Turturro, is the one doing it. And the reason he assumes that is because Bernie happens to be gay and Jewish. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of like epithets in this that I'm not going to repeat. Shmata is antiquated enough that you kind of can.
Yeah.
They call him the Shmata all the time. I had to look it up. It means like a ragged piece of clothing that's falling off your bones. So it's obviously like offensive slang for Jews at the time.
Yeah.
So because he's like Jewish and gay, the guy's like, it must be him. He has no principles. You know, he's corrupt inside. But Bernie Birnbaum belongs to Albert Finney. And Leo, Albert Finney, says, no, you don't have any proof. You can't kill my guy. Casper just wants permission to kill this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he says no. And Casper says, then I'll go to war, overthrow you, and destroy you and become the new head mafia guy. And basically the pickle our hero is in is he says, Leo, you got to admit that you're not going to win this war. This guy's power is rising. Yours is falling. You should let him kill Bernie Birnbaum.
There's three lines of dialogue that in that the last three lines of that scene in Leo's office, some brilliant screenwriting. Tom, think about what protecting Bernie gets us. Think about what offending Casper loses us. Leo, oh, come on, Tommy. You know I don't like to think. Tom, yeah, well, think about whether you should start.
Yeah, think about whether you should start thinking. Yeah. In that same scene, and this will come back, I actually think this is in sort of Casper's pedagogy. He has this underlying symbolic arc of representing the honorable thief, the existence of an honorable thief, or who believes that honor could exist in that situation. So he says, it's getting so a businessman can't expect a return on a fixed fight. If you can't trust a fix, what can you trust? This is a matter of character, ethics.
Yeah. He mentions ethics three times.
And he's a mass murdering mobster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But ethics
and
is very important.
A bad father who slaps his son.
Yeah.
Even though his son's a piece of shit.
Yeah. Other just great lines from that scene. So you want to kill Bernie? Yeah, for starters. And then when he says no, Casper says his favorite catchphrase. You're giving me the hi-hat. And Leo says what I think is an even better response. You know what? Take your flunky and dangle.
Yeah. There's so much archaic language and slang. I'm such a big fan of slang.
The Coens, obviously throughout their whole career,
I think
more than most screenwriters, will take inspiration from a dialect choice.
Yeah.
Like, and they don't care if it's accurate. Like people in Raising Arizona famously said, what are all these crazy Southern accents? No one from Arizona sounds like any of these characters. And they were like, right, it was an artistic choice that everyone in our fictive world has a unique dialect, because that's a heart of a lot of our scripts is the dialect.
Right, right. And so most like, you got a lip on you. You know, it's like, it's not that like, you don't have to know the slang.
They're not beating you over the head with it.
Yeah. Like you understand what it is. You've heard that. But just like Verna saying, what are you chewing over? You know, like, yeah, I know what that means. No one in my life ever says chewing to mean like pondering.
Wake up, Tommy. I am awake. Your eyes are shut. Who are you going to believe?
Who are you going
to
believe?
So getting back to his central predicament, though. The reason Leo won't let Bernie be killed, which would solve all his problems, is because Bernie is Verna's brother.
Yes.
If you can believe it or not, Bernie Birnbaum and Verna Birnbaum. And
just two siblings.
She's this young, beautiful, vivacious woman that loves Leo, or does she, right? Because she is sleeping with this rich older mobster in exchange in some way for him to protect her brother at all costs.
Right.
So it is wholly unclear. But of course she says, no, but I also like him. What's wrong with me wanting to protect my brother and I can have sex with whoever I want? Like, you know, but Gabriel Byrne, who's also having sex with her, this is where the mind fuck begins, is like, but you're having sex with me. So I know for a fact, because I am betraying Leo, that Leo's getting played. Then he goes into the next room and advises Leo, you're getting played, dude. But he can't admit that he knows he's getting played because he's the guy playing him.
He also calls both of them more or less grifters. Like they just, whatever the Birnbaums, like whatever town they're in, they just, they can't help themselves. They need to just make a buck.
Right.
Like, they need to, like, in terms of, which is a big thesis of this film, which is just like, every friend, someone's like, we're friends, It actually kind of means like we're friends now, but we're enemies later, and mm-hmm. like no one's truly friends. And so they're all grifters, but like Tommy like comes down hard on Vernon about how Bernie is a like he's just trying to get an extra buck Tommy, at any time.
Tommy constantly projects his own self-loathing,
which is onto what he
the does. People around him. It's a repeated tactic for him, yeah. Right? Like he goes to Leo and goes like, "You're being a fucking idiot," and you know that he's telling that to himself. Because right. he's like loyal to Leo and he's like, why am I doing this? And he'll have sex with Verna and then call Verna a whore for betraying Leo. And it's like, dude, you're talking to yourself.
Yeah. He can't. And Tommy, ultimately, the problem that propels, it's like an eternal struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Like this movie has superfluous random like circumstance, like in most noirs, mm-hmm. Where he does have, he's a man with a plan. He's trying to do things, but serendipitously things happen to him and he just adjusts
the plan,
which
yeah.
is a Coen Brothers, you know, like thing in their hat.
It's not
like
Ocean's 11 where nothing ever complicates the plan,
right?
The plan evolves as challenges yeah. arise.
So
yeah.
he has a plan, but he also is a principled man, he says. And so he believes that there's two types of people with plans and people who have principles. And the problem is that he doesn't know which one he is. He says he's
until
a principled
the end of
person,
the film.
But he has a plan and he wants to get out of his situation and still wear his hat, so to speak, which is kind of a
right.
Yeah.
So, his A goal is loyalty to Leo.
Yeah.
And he does feel that it's a principle, and we see that principle hold up to challenges when it shouldn't.
Right.
And a good example is the very next sequence is Casper getting him pulled off the street separately to have a private meeting and go, look, I know you're smart. I know that we all know Leo's just doing this for this dame. Like, I'm going to go to war. And like, I don't want that. It costs right. me money. Dozens of my guys will die. Dozens of your guys will die. But I will go to war over this.
Right.
And he goes, what about I cut you a check for $100,000 right now? You tell me where Bernie is, and you just take that secret to your grave. Don't tell Leo you told me.
Yeah.
And he says, and if you say no, my guys are going to beat the shit out of you right now.
Right.
And even though he just came from Leo's office where he advised Leo that that is exactly what they should do, he can't do it because the offer is without Leo's consent.
Right.
His principal is like, well, I wish I could do that, but that's not the game. That's not the rules of the game I play.
They come in and try to beat the shit out of him, and he hits one with a chair. And I love that little moment. That's what Coen Brothers are so good about. That scene is so good. And when he hits him with the chair, and he goes, Jesus, Tommy.
Well, just to set up. So, yeah. So he says no. And Casper goes, all right. And one goon comes out.
Yeah.
And Tommy just takes off his coat.
It's Frankie.
Looking like he's going to fight. But then at the last second, he wallops the guy in the face with a chair. Yeah.
Who, by the way, Tom never throws a punch in the entire film. He only takes punches.
The only thing he ever does is swing the chair.
And I think that the chair swing is so that he actually doesn't, like...
Throw a punch.
Because
he's not a fighter. Because
I think that they knew that they could get away with that. Because they wanted to make him a man of nonviolence, but then they had to rectify scene-wise.
Well, because, yeah.
Him anticipating a punch. And
right.
So they chose a chair.
Spoiler alert, he decides on principle over having a soul, because
right.
one of his final lines is, what heart? And he does kill someone. We'll get to that. But like, yeah, he takes one life in the film. And it's that moment that where you're like, oh, his soul is damned.
Yeah.
And it would lose its punch if he had been like an action hero up to that point.
Which surprisingly makes him a better gangster, because now he's willing to kill people.
Yeah.
Instead of being like this puppeteer. But that action is what makes the actual end of the film, where he walks away from
the job
Albert
itself,
Finney.
Yeah.
And he's just like, I'm going out to another city. Like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
So he's actually, at his heart, he's not a good man,
mm-hmm.
but he does not have the stomach to be a bad man.
So I would say, to keep people on track, there is an A plot and a B plot in this film, but they're
right.
both, the film stays very close to Tommy. They're both goals of his. His main goal is this overarching gang war and somehow helping Leo end up on top, or limiting the amount of devastation that is done to Leo's organization. His B plot is, which we need to make a point of, he's a terrible gambler. It's a B plot so that will be strung throughout.
And Leo multiple times says, like, I'll settle your debts.
It's another part of his principle. Leo says, are you crazy? I'm the Godfather. I'm like the Godfather from Godfather. And everyone knows who you are. If you told this low-level bookie, just forgive my 35 grand or Leo will cover it, I would cover it. That's one of the perks of being in the mafia. And he's like, no, I don't want your charity. You know, like, that's not how I roll. That's not my principle. I made the bet. I'll pay the bet back. Mm-hmm. So there's this guy who keeps sending goons to say, like, please don't make us break your legs. Can't Leo just cover it? And he's like, I'll pay back. And he goes, another bet in the fifth on this. And they go, don't do it, man. It's not going to.
Like, I got to do it.
So he has
500.
He's on the worst streak of his life. And that's a B plot that comes up throughout. I think we should highlight, not really go into because it's pedagogy, but highlight that the major like symbolic tropes are his heart. People constantly mention his heart.
Yep.
And hats.
Yeah.
And if you've ever listened to the great history podcast, The Dollop, they have proven many times over, there are times in American history where hats are the most important. That's like your most important
thing.
They're
a symbol of status.
They're a symbol of status, of class, of everything. Yeah.
To be continued.
All right. So where are we? He's in the warehouse. He hits the guy with the chair. And the funny part is the guy he hits, who's a goon who's coming to beat
him up. They all know each other. So they're like friends kind of. But it was like, I got to beat you down. Sorry, man.
And he's offended that he hit him with the chair. He's like, Jesus. Tommy.
Like, just take the beating,
just
man.
Take the beating, exactly.
Yeah, I'm not going to kill you.
Yeah.
Why do you have to come at me with the chair?
So then before he can get beat too bad, though, the cops rush in because currently, and this is important because it's going to change, Leo owns the mayor's office and the police force. So they are totally compromised by that mob and they work for that mob. So they come in and beat the shit out of the guys that were beating the shit out of him and just let him go. Mm-hmm. And of course, later we will see as Casper gains influence, it's a great technique. There's an identical shot. The A shot is one time in Leo's office, you see him having cigars with the mayor and the chief of police and they're all smiley and buddy-buddy with this mobster. At the mirror image point in the third act, you go into Casper's office, and in an identical shot, they're there now.
Yeah.
And Tommy's like, weird to see you guys here. And they're like, oh, Casper's always been a pillar of the community.
And that symmetry does not change, like, because I also want to point out the two attacks on the street where Tommy goes and he drinks a bottle and he throws it away, and then he gets in Act 3, he gets a glass from the chief of police.
Mm-hmm.
Basically what it is that it's two different sides of like essentially the same street. Like it's not the same location, but it's like this, everything's screen direction left to right in the first one. And then everything's a mirror image and right to left on the second, down to who's over whose shoulder. Which in the second case, Sam Raimi plays one of the gangsters who just shoots and then dies.
Look for that Sam Raimi cameo. Yeah. In fact, he plays like the worst cop ever.
Yeah.
They yell, hey, okay, we're going to stop shooting, but you guys got to come out with your hands up. And a guy comes out with his hands empty, waving a white flag. Sam Raimi looks at the other cops like, get a load of this, steps forward and shoots that guy in cold blood.
And then he gets shot, yeah.
And then he immediately gets shot back.
And so the two like street gun battles are punctuated by Tommy talking to the chief of police. And in both cases, they're literally mirror images of themselves.
Yes, meaning. So, okay.
So that's twice now.
When the power changes hands, Leo, of course, uses the police to raid Casper's places.
Right.
And Casper uses the police to raid Leo's places.
Right.
And in both instances, what Abe's saying, one time the bullets are going from left to right into the plate glass, and one time it's the same shot, but they're going from right to left into the plate glass.
And it's to
these shots are an hour apart. So I love that it's not like they're not going, look at this thing we did. You got to remember that.
Yeah.
And in both sequences, Tommy happens to be out inside. He happens to stumble out and have
to take a drink,
a conversation with the chief of police. But what I think is illuminating about those pair of scenes is the first time the chief of police, in the first instance, he's nominally loyal to Leo. And the chief of police is bitching about how Leo really shouldn't start this war. It's stupid. He should just let Bernie go. And even though Gabriel Byrne, again, agrees with him, we know he does. Yeah. He just told Leo that's his advice. He like grabs him by the collar and is like, how dare you question Leo?
How dare you, betray Leo?
You do whatever the fuck he tells you to do.
Said by Judas. Yeah.
Exactly. And then what's funny to me is after he is flipped and he's nominally loyal to Casper, he comes out and talks to the chief of police, and the chief of police goes, this war is pretty crazy, huh? I think Casper should chill out. And he goes, yeah, probably. So it's like a clue that he's not truly loyal to Casper.
No, he's not.
No.
He's a betrayer and a non-loyalist in both sides of... So he's Yojimbo.
But know? I do think there's clues that this the whole time this was a bromance.
Yeah.
In his heart of hearts, he was always...
He's Leo's man.
What's sad is he really does love Verna.
Yeah.
Like, he has the feelings of attraction and love for her, but he never loved her more than he loved Leo. I feel that he would always sacrifice her for Leo.
I think you're right about that. I think because he has convinced himself he's a principled man,
mm-hmm.
and he's not a man with a plan.
Right.
He's just a principled man, and his principle is to follow Leo. The problem is that he also is a man with a plan and wants to run away with Verna, and that's antithetical to... His
what
purpose,
he thought
his
identity was, yeah.
So that's, and so in other words, and which is, I mean, we're skipping right into pedagogy, but that's kind of true about this film because there's not like the story is already laid out. Like I don't know, but it's insane to me that like the true purpose of I think those scenes. And especially of just in general, his inability to resolve his reality.
Mm-hmm.
He can't rectify it. And it's not a plight on him. It's a blight on the people he leaves in his wake.
And he gives us very few clues to his interior life. This is a cold character. You don't feel yourself attaching to him or finding yourself charmed by him. And I think that's because, and that's the question, if you're just a machine that accomplishes goals, and this is what they say several times, like Verna, everyone has a different theory. Verna says, no, you have a heart. Right. You just put on this cold front, right? That's an obvious theory for a guy like that. By the end of the movie, he says, no, I really don't think I have a heart inside.
Right.
And that's the chilling end beat of this is like, oh, that's
which
what he found out about
he
himself.
He has said from the beginning, though, like there's a sequence of lines where he tells. So at also as a kind of C plot that just comes in.
The runner about Mink and the Dane?
Rug Daniels.
Oh, right.
The politician dies and is shot. And the way they do that is beautiful because the way they physically like the shots are a shot of a kid looking at a dead body and then. The dead body breathes and he's like, oh shit, he's still alive. And then he takes his toupee.
He steals his toupee.
And then he runs away. And
but
there's a shot of a dog.
Also,
as well.
The tone of the scene, it's not, you can't appreciate it unless you know it's a beautiful, bright, like dawn morning that makes the cobblestones glow. And someone off screen is whistling a beautiful, jaunty tune throughout the whole sequence.
Right.
So it's this kid. Looking at this grotesque dead body on a beautiful morning where you hear someone going like,
yep.
It's such like a weird tone. I loved it.
It's such
and it ends on a shot of like a cute puppy.
Yeah. And so that becomes relevant later because everyone's like, why'd they take his toupee? Because they all are blaming each other for his death.
We're not going to be able to connect every explanation.
Which the reality is that Mink actually shot him because of things that were going to go on.
Other things.
But I just wanted to before we move to that point, just wanted to point out dialogue about Tom and Verna. At one point, Tom arrives at her like vanity, like where she's putting on her makeup.
At the club.
And he says, Rug Daniels is dead. And Verna says, gee, that's tough. And then Tom says, don't get hysterical.
Yeah, well, that all deadpan.
Right. And so he doesn't actually have feelings.
Yeah.
Like he doesn't have a heart.
And you also see in that scene, which is roughly where we are in the flow of diegesis, that he leans on her really hard to give Bernie up. Basically says, come on, let us kill your sister or your brother. Yeah. And when she says no, he says, well, you realize then you're just a whore because you're just having sex with Leo. It's so, what I love is the layered complexity of the love emotion. Like, this is such a complex love triangle on for everyone, because he's like, you're just a whore. And then she's like, then why are you fucking sleeping with me? And he's like, because I love you, kid. And then kisses her in like a forceful way.
Right.
So violently that she slaps him.
Yeah. She's
but you know, he means both. He hates her and loves her at the same time, which is a rare situation to be in. He throws a whiskey glass, destroying her vanity. And there's great lines there. She says, I suppose you think you raised hell. And he says, sister, when I raise hell, you'll know it.
You'll know it. Yeah.
So
that's so good.
Basically, what propels the plot next is he comes home. After all, we know all these things. This war is brewing. There's the love triangle. Everything's set up. He's got gambling problems. He comes home one night. And this is a great recurring technique in this film. This film has at least four moments where there's a long, long shot where you think you're just in a room watching a simple transaction. And then it pans over and there's a dude sitting there. They do that like four times in this.
Yeah, yeah.
So he goes.
Usually with the Dane.
Yeah. He calmly takes off his jacket, gets undressed for bed, sits on the bed, and then looks off camera in a way where you're like, what is he looking at? And he goes, hey, Bernie.
Hey, Bernie.
And it pans over and John Turturro's there. And John Turturro goes,
after
yeah.
He's supposedly killed him.
Hey, Tommy, what's the rumpus? No, no, not yet.
Oh.
This is the first beat of that. He has literally just come by to beg, to say,
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Look, you have the ear of the Godfather. Please tell him I'm a good guy. Mm-hmm. And he goes, yeah, that's what I've been hearing. You obviously have a bunch of friends who've been coming forward to say you're a good guy. Your sister's vouching for you. And this is one of my favorite aspects. Bernie is basically Loki. Like, Bernie is solely an agent of fucking chaos.
Well, he's always trying to get his.
Right, but what I love is... His sister is risking so much to save his life.
He doesn't.
Yet behind her back.
That doesn't matter.
The way he talks about her is so cruel. Right.
Yeah.
Like he says, can you believe she's fucking me and Leo? And he goes, of course I can. She's crazy. You know, she tried to fuck me when I was growing up to make me ungay, to like ungay
right,
me.
Right.
And instead of thinking of that as like, wow, that must have been hard for her too. He's like, she's a sick twist. All right. Like, yeah, what a sick fuck she was.
Yeah, well, you stick by your family.
Well, that's okay. So that's the lines I love. He goes on and on. He goes, yeah, she's a freak, man. She tried to fuck me when I was a kid. She's sick. And he goes, well, she speaks very highly of you. Yeah, well, you stick by your family.
Yeah, she's a sick twist, all right.
Yep. So basically, everyone wants to bribe this man of principle to betray his principles. And this is right. Bernie's attempt. He says, I know the bookie Lazaro who you owe all the money to. I can clear the debt if you'll just advise Leo not to kill me or let Casper kill me. And he says, look, Casper already offered to clear the debt. And I said, no, obviously I'm going to say no to you. Next is actually the warehouse scene where he gets beat up by Casper.
But, oh, right.
But the point is, like an old joke, we have two beats of he refuses. He gets another offer. He refuses. He gets an even sweeter offer. He refuses. He's not going to betray Leo.
Right. And by the way, at the beginning of the... club scene, he meets Mink before he walks into Verna's room. Who's Steve Buscemi, and Mink is just, it's clear that Mink's up to something.
Mink is terrified for his life.
Yeah, yeah. And clearly in cahoots with Bernie.
And clearly aware that he doesn't know how these chips are going to land between Leo and Casper, and he doesn't want people to think he was involved with Bernie, but everyone kind of knows.
Knows, yeah.
And so
and he's like, fuck.
This is like a D plot. This movie has lots of levels of plot, but there's just a couple scenes where Buscemi is coming up, and they're always used for great comedic effect. Comes up to Tommy, and Tommy basically fucks with him. He goes like, Tommy, you know, I just wanted to say Bernie's a great guy, but you didn't hear that from me. I'm just advising you. I don't think you should kill him or anyone who worked with him. Like, I don't think what he did was
we're
so
friends,
bad.
We're friends. We're
friends. And he goes, and you wouldn't. And then all Tommy says is something like, I'll make sure to tell Leo what you said about you and Bernie working together. And he goes, oh, no, Jesus, Tommy. Who said that? That's not Tommy, Jesus.
Tommy, why would you do that?
But basically... Because of his refusal, Leo's continued to refusal to let Casper kill Bernie because he loves Verna, the war begins. And we already talked about police raids go back and forth, but then finally things come to a head in a scene I would like you to describe because you did the kissy noise about Albert Finney, so you should describe the most badass thing Albert Finney will ever do on film.
Are you talking about his
the attempt on his life? This is the act break.
I
now.
Love how it starts with the cigar.
Yeah.
Because he's just enjoying a night in front of the fire, you know, having a sherry or something.
He's listening to Danny Boy, the Pipes Are Calling on a phonograph.
Yeah. Which, you know, when we were watching it together, we were both like, oh, yeah, they didn't really have, there's not a lot of Irish tunes that you could listen on phonograph at this time.
Even the richest mobster has shit music.
Even though it's just Danny Boy, it's like, yeah, it makes sense that. Like, even though it's like kind of a funeral tune.
It is. It's played traditionally funeral. So
yeah. So foreshadowing, even though he doesn't die. So.
I mean, for all the other folks in the scene.
Right. It's just death has crept up on him.
Yeah.
What I love about what's painterly about this sequence is that he hears downstairs like a quietness, like an abrupt someone's breaking in. And then he puts out a cigar, puts it in his robe pocket,
mm-hmm.
and grabs his gun. And as
then
they
you see smoke rise from between
the
floorboards.
Yeah, because they're burning. And he's like, that's when he knows. He's like, they're trying to kill me.
Yeah.
And when they bust in, he gets under the bed and shoots them in the feet and then puts one in the brain, because you always put one in the brain.
Repeated motif is the mobsters have the rule that the whack is not complete till you go up and put one in the brain.
Yeah, and so he shoots, which was also referenced in No Country for Old Men, I believe.
Same technique.
Yeah.
It's a real technique.
Shoot the legs, they fall, shoot the brain.
They actually, that's part of SWAT training, is the double tap technique for under cars. Yeah. That's how you get someone who's hiding behind a car.
And so a scuffle happens, but what's amazing about Albert Finney is that, Gabriel Byrne does it later, in the movie,
he learned
it from Leo. Just the idea of like, oh, so there's another one in the house. I'm going to like put all of my fucking cards on the idea that he thinks that I'm still up here, and I'm gonna just remove the rug right from beneath him. So here's what I'm gonna do, is I'm gonna grab a fucking Tommy gun, jump out a window, and just wait for him to inspect my room,
because he wouldn't think that an old man would have jumped out of the two-story window.
And just and he does it with like a fucking
aplomb
and he just shoots him forever. And then
Albert Finney, the guy goes, just looks around like, huh, and Albert Finney just shoots him for like 7.5 minutes.
Yeah, it's just long, which is like a thing that I think the Coen brothers were doing.
I think it's an homage to
classic
gangster films.
Because in the Sam
Raimi
sequence too, it's like just way too many bullets.
Which, if you watch old gangster movies, when you got hit with a Tommy gun, you would stay upright for so long going, ow, God.
I think it's pretty an intentional, like it's comedic to the Coen brothers that how much they shoot him. Because the guy gets like 80 bullets in him, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, there's also the getaway car. And so they drive around in this, you know, Ford model something.
Model T or shit.
And what's amazing is he just keeps shooting. So he's already killed the guy upstairs, but he sees the car going away and he just shoots the shit out of the back of the car, killing the driver. Killing everyone, really,
right,
with his bullets.
So the car
and
crashes.
The car crashes and explodes, and then he puts the cigar back into his mouth
and lights it. Yeah,
yeah, it's like it's just like business as usual for Albert Finney,
right?
And he's just so effective, which is what is referenced later, because then the following scene.
I could still trade body blows with any man in this town.
And Gabriel Byrne is just like, why would?
But why would you?
I told you about this Bernie thing. Why are you inviting a war with Casper?
You can't take a war. And he's like, fuck you, I can take
a
war.
He's like, I'm good at fighting.
He's kind of Robert Baratheon, where he's like older, but he's still like, don't call me old. I could fucking beat anyone at war still. Fuck you.
Maybe not you, but I can beat
most
that's, of
them. He says that to Tommy to be nice. He goes like, yeah, I could kill anyone, Tommy. Never you, Tommy. Not you.
Which is, because they have that mutual love.
It's a bromance. The movie's a bromance. Because Verna's eventually cast aside by Tommy, at least.
Right. Gangster bromance.
So, of course, this causes a rumpus.
Yeah.
Another term used in the film a lot. Tommy busts into Leo's office like, what the fuck are we going to do? And Leo's like, what, it was an adventure, relax. You know, he's not being worried enough to make Tommy feel that he's thinking. Again, Tommy doesn't think Leo thinks enough.
Right. Which I think is also funny because Casper at one point says, one thing I always try to teach my boys, always put one in the brain.
Yeah.
Which is a bullet, but also yeah. it's an idea.
Like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, because that's how Tommy marionettes.
Oh, my stretch, the one I don't know if it's intentional, but I got a stretch out of it, was the line in this sequence where he says, so he's okay, he wasn't even injured, and he yeah. goes, old man is still an artist with a Thompson.
Yeah.
And Thompson is also called a Tommy. So, and his name's Tommy, so yeah. it's like Leo still has you wrapped around his finger.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that a lot.
Anyway, in this sequence, totally offhandedly, Tommy finds out that the slug they dug out of Rug is a 22, which is a bullet that is particular to a small kind of gun that Verna has. Right. So as a side note, in his love triangle,
it's like a Derringer, a single shot.
He has even more reason to think that Verna's a phony and just playing him. He loves
her. He thinks that she killed Rug.
He thinks she killed Rug.
Because Leo put
Rug on her as a tail.
Yeah.
But of course, in the end, which is great because it's the one plot point that doesn't connect. And I was sitting there typing like, what is this?
Even Tommy doesn't
There's
know.
A plot hole. And then finally,
Bernie's
at the end,
the only one who knows.
Bernie, he goes, whatever happened to Rug? Who shot Rug? Oh, Mink shot Rug. Why? I don't. It was a misunderstanding. Yeah. So it's like some shit can just happen.
Like he yeah. thought he was tailing
him.
Mink thought
and
he was
Mink
tailing
him. And Mink is paranoid,
him.
But it had nothing to do with anything. Yeah. It was a coincidence. Yeah.
It was just because
he hangs out with Verna.
Had Mink didn't want anyone to know that he and Bernie were in cahoots.
Were lovers also.
So,
yeah.
So, in other words, he thought he was tailing him to get, like, some vig
dirt
on
him.
Yeah.
Especially because...
But it wasn't even involved.
The thing you need
it
to know about
Verna.
Mink is... Mink and Dane are in a committed gay relationship.
Yeah.
And the Dane is Casper's Tommy. The Dane right. is his consigliere. And whereas in the Leo-Tommy situation, Leo's the muscle and Tommy thinks, it's vice versa with Casper. Casper's the man with the plan, and the Dane is basically a scary Anton Chigurh-like monster.
Right. Who? Oh, my God. He's so good, though, because he's silent for the first half of the right. time he's on screen. Just... He only has talked when they like point at him.
He only ever talks to Tommy, and all he ever says is, "That's real funny.
That's real funny.
You're a smart guy.
Very smart.
Yeah.
What you doing at the club talking things over with Leo? You know, like he's a perfect detective.
Yes.
Because he's just quiet and asks questions.
And of course, he does end up piecing shit together.
You're too goddamn smart. Like, in his opinion, the talk is nonsense.
But the point is, Mink killed Rug because he was afraid that Rug was being sent by the Dane, and then the Dane would find out he's cheating on him. But that's actually not what was happening. Leo had sent Rug to follow Verna,
mm-hmm.
blah, 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 blah,
but
blah.
Now we have a land war.
We have a land war in Asia.
Yes.
Okay, so this is the big change in the Leo-Tommy relationship, because he says... Look, after this, they're obviously coming for blood. This is a full-on land war. You're going to have to be in protection from now on, like moving from place to place every night, checking for car bombs and shit. This is stupid. Break up with Verna. And he goes, it's funny you should say that. I had decided to ask her to marry me.
Yeah.
And he goes, look, Leo, this is hard to say, but Verna's fucking me, okay? So she doesn't care about you. Break up with Verna. And Leo is even still like, oh, that sucks, but I bet we could work through it.
Get out, though.
But get out, please, for fucking my girlfriend.
Walking down the hallway.
And yeah, and Tommy's like, yeah, like, you, it's either me or this plan, this crazy plan where you marry Verna and protect Bernie is fucking stupid.
Yeah.
And he goes, then get out. And he leaves his office.
And then Finney comes. Like,
Finney takes his jacket off slowly
takes
inside the
yeah,
office.
Yeah, and he, so there's about 15 seconds of... off-screen happening where Albert Finney is like
thinking,
I'm, you know what, I'm mad, you know what, I need to hit him,
yeah,
you know what. And then he goes out, and while Gabriel Byrne is walking down the corridor, he just beats the shit out of Tommy. So Leo is now turning against his own consigliere,
and he takes it like in the way where if the mob boss starts beating you in the club,
you do not fight back.
Yeah.
And he beats him in like, in a way, kind of reminiscent of Raising Arizona. Like, when he decks him off his feet, he's somehow transported like 20 feet back. Yeah. Just to, I guess, to show the prowess of fighting of Leo, like that he really is a good fighter. Like, in addition to, he's fighting a guy who isn't really putting up a fight, but like when he does punch you, he's good.
And and it becomes official because it's like someone in the audience is like, I guess he's out of the gang or whatever. And he's like, that's right, it's the kiss off.
Yeah, it's the kiss off.
If I ever see him again, it'll be too soon.
Yeah. Ah, such good language there.
Yeah, so.
Kiss off, because it's like the kiss of death, but it's also like.
They refreshed it.
It's also like, I kiss you, though, because I do love you. Yeah. You just You broke my heart.
The Coens take old tropes, but they never let them be just tropes. They refresh them in their own unique way.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that makes every film feel alive. So. Now we've reached the midpoint.
Yeah, which now starts like everything, because everything is now coming at Tommy. Like, so the thing we haven't talked about is Lazar.
We have a bit. That's the guy he owes all the gambling debt to.
So now everyone in town knows that Leo is not protecting Tommy anymore. And Tommy is a guy who is very effective, so that's why Casper like courts him. But also he's got all these debts that like Lazar knows that he's not going to plan. So now like he's got tails, he's got messengers coming at him to threatening him like throughout the rest of the movie.
Fern is still coming at him to ask, why the fuck did you do that? Like, and why'd you tell him? Why'd you ruin my thing with Leo?
So Tom meets up in the Yonjimbo way. He's like, well, now I don't have that protection, so I'm going to go to Casper.
And I want to say this now, he ends up being in Casper's gang. And a series of events unfold in which, as you said, sometimes it's clear that he has the plan in hand and is the manipulator. Sometimes he's responding to events he couldn't have predicted.
Right.
It does ultimately end in Leo's victory. And at the end, Leo says, I didn't know you were a double agent the whole time. You should have told me. And he accepts that truth. Like he says, I was a double agent.
Yeah.
But I'm not so sure. Like, I wonder, and the movie I don't think really tells you, at the beginning of his relationship with Casper, do you think he ever really thought, I'm going to be Casper's man now, fuck
no,
Leo?
No way.
You think like his beating heart is loyalty to Leo at all costs?
He's trying to fuck Leo because he loves him so much. In other words, he's trying to show him pain because he's like, you didn't do what I said, Leo.
He says, if I show you enough pain, so you will give up Bernie,
you'll
and
see
this
my
will
value.
Solve your thing.
Yeah.
But you think ultimately,
I'm
going to
kill Bernie. But he can't even kill Bernie.
Right. Okay. So that's what. So basically, if we accept that as truth, Tommy's goal is to get Bernie killed because that would end the war.
Yeah.
So he goes to Casper and says, look, I have fresh bruises. Leo threw me out. I'm fucking his fiance. Isn't that enough to prove I'm ready to flip?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, not really. You know what would prove it? Kill Bernie personally.
Take him out. Put one in his brain.
Yeah. And the Dane, important point, never buys his shit. The Dane from Square One is like, Casper, this guy's a double agent. He loves Leo. He's going to fuck us. And from Square One, which is very wise, Tommy is planting seeds in Casper's brain about like, don't you think it could be the Dane is just jealous or maybe he's the double agent? Like things like that.
So,
there's this weird shit with Mink and Mink works with Bernie. Maybe the Dane is in on it.
So Dane's not there for this one, so it's Frankie and Tic Tac.
Frankie and Tic Tac.
And which are just great gangster names.
The gangster names in this are terrible. Mink, Rug, Frankie, and Tic Tac.
And
the Dane.
Yeah. So they go out and they know where Bernie is because Mink let that information, which is kind of the peace offering that Tommy gives to Casper, is I know exactly
he's in this
where
hotel
he is,
room, right?
And
actually,
the Dane's like, don't touch Mink.
We have to mention, actually, that's one of his key losing his soul moments because Mink didn't slip.
Oh, yeah, with Verna?
He fucks Verna one last time. And then in the aftermath of making love, he says, by the way, where exactly is Bernie staying? And she says, why do you need to know that?
And
he says, Leo's no longer protecting him because I'm not in his ear and we had a big fight. So I better go there and tell him to split.
Yeah.
But you know that he just used a woman he loved to kill
her
own
brother.
Yeah.
And got the information for the killing stroke.
And then I love that. I think it's clear in the direction. You can see in her eyes, because they linger on her at the end of the scene, She knows that that might be what's going on.
Yeah.
That it could be either way.
You got no heart. What, you know?
She says, you got a heart. You just, it's just so tiny and you can't remember the last time you used it.
What heart?
Yeah.
So they go out and in, so at the top of this podcast, the best, the performance I'm alluding to really for Totoro is this sequence, which is they go out into the woods. And he pleads for his life. And it's a dream, actually. The woods represent something that we were talking about, which we'll get to later. But they go out into the woods.
Wait, this is not literally a dream sequence. Just so
it's not a literally
confused.
A dream sequence. Okay. He just, Tommy has a dream about going out to the woods.
Right.
And we were going to talk about in later what the woods means.
We're going to talk about his dreams in pedagogy.
And what hats
obviously.
Mean.
Dreams are always
hats
symbolic
and woods,
clues.
Which
yeah.
are the poster of this movie. But anyway, Tic Tac and Frankie don't need to see the murder. So they just say, take this gun, go out and shoot him. And then it's just a monologue of John Turturro.
Gabriel Byrne does not speak.
Doesn't, yeah.
It's like a 4-minute scene.
And it's fucking insane, this performance. Because he's just crying.
Exactly. And it escalates. He Rolodexes every possible tactic, playing it off like, this isn't going to happen.
I'm
You're
gonna
not this
bargain
guy.
I'm going to bargain with you then, and we'll get out of this. Oh my God, you're really doing this? But you know me. You know me. You wouldn't be the guy to
and
do this.
And then breaking down to like, look, let's be more honest than we've ever been in our lives. We're all mobsters. These guys are animals. But I can see in your eyes, you're not like that. You're,
and he's right.
And I've never killed someone. Really. I've ripped a lot of people off. I've never killed someone. Don't you worry, you'll be judged for that. Like, I know you haven't passed that threshold. You don't want to do this. And it just escalates. We cannot do it justice. Watch the sequence. It ends with,
it's
he only was given the lines, I'm praying to you, look in your heart.
Yeah.
And he's allowed to repeat them as long as he wants. He repeats them like 30 times and they're amazing.
Yeah, and it's insane. So the resolve of this
is now, this
that
is, I think, very important because he says, look in your heart. And we know that a thesis of the film is,
what heart?
Does this guy have a heart? And this is one of the few times where it's evidence on the other end of the spectrum.
Right. He actually, God, I was just, I'm just a grifter. Tom, I'm a nobody. But I'll tell you what. I've never crossed a friend, Tom. I've never killed anybody. I've never crossed a friend, nor you. I'll bet. We're not like those animals. This is not us. You know, it's just...
Well, now they don't have to see it because you did it way better than Totoro.
No, I didn't. It's just... he's like praying to him.
Yeah.
And he's asking him to look in his heart. And then Tom does this ridiculous thing where he,
it's another one.
No
of the,
reason
mm-hmm.
if he is a man with principle,
right,
or a man with a plan, one of those two, he does this third thing.
Well, this is the whole reason he got to this point. This was his whole
he has
goal.
A heart.
He wants Bernie to be dead. That would solve everything.
Yeah, this solves everything. He concocted this plan with the punctuation of, I'll take the information from Verna. I'll go to Casper. I will kill this. But he looks
in
him
moment,
in the
he
eyes.
He can't do it.
He's on the ground.
Yeah.
And he says, get the fuck out of here.
You're dead.
You're dead.
And he goes, I understand.
You
I'm dead.
Do
God
not
bless you.
Come
and he
back.
Says, don't God bless me. You're dead. You can't talk.
You can't
leave.
Be here. You're just
yeah,
gone.
Yeah. So he runs away. And I love this crossfade. Because
and he does two pops to show
to pretend he killed
Frankie
him.
And Tic Tac here, two gunshots.
Yeah. But also he, well, first of all, it's another one of their pullback reveals because in the first gun pop, it cuts to a chest upshot
of
Totoro kneeling
in,
on the
like,
ground.
In pain, yeah.
In pain. And you could easily believe, oh, he shot him in the gut and they're about to pan down. But then it like takes a long few seconds to realize, oh no, he shot the
he
ground.
He just shot the ground, yeah.
And I love that reveal. And then the other just technique I love in this sequence is, after he runs away, we're on a wide shot of Tommy in profile facing right, and it crossfades such that he is perfectly overlaid on the profile of Tic Tac facing right.
Right.
And it's a very simple thing, but it's just saying he did the thing, and now he's one of them. He's in the gang. Like now
everything
he
else
them.
Was left to right, now it's right to left.
Yeah. Right. So
simple screen direction.
But it just tells you this worked. He earned their loyalty and he is in the gang. And that's true. From this point forward, K Casper starts to rely on him more and more as his trusted consigliere because he is smart. And he successively starts manipulating Casper into trusting Dane less and less.
And this is where we start seeing things where, you know, so you have the right side, you have the left side, the sinister side. This is also mimicked in the Dane is always on the right side of frame and Tommy's always on the left side of frame. Go and watch this movie and pay attention to what shoulder and what side of frame, because those are two different things, Tommy is over Leo and Casper. You'll notice that there's a symmetry there as well.
And that it's often shot like he's the devil on their shoulder whispering in their
ear. Yeah, he's the right-hand man. Yeah. And then
he's Casper's left-hand man because he's giving him bad advice.
Because the Dane's the right-hand man. Right. And then they swap.
So
which later happens.
There's a lot of interplay between that, which is basically just Dane's suspicions escalating, because I want to speed things through diegesis. But all you need to know is it gets to the point where Casper's really wrapped around Tommy's finger, and at the same moment, the Dane says, fuck this, I'm going to do something about it. I know this guy's full of shit. So and, what he does is he grabs Tommy, and he says, you're going to take me right now to the woods and show me Bernie's body. Why would it not still be there?
Yeah. It's days later. Right. He should be corpsified.
And you know it's not. So yet again, incredibly tense wood sequence.
Dramatic irony.
Your heart is in your fucking chest.
Because you're like, Tom's dead.
And Tom stops to throw up.
Yeah.
And Dane's like, do you see? He's scared. We know the truth now.
And then Frankie's like,
why would he throw up? Well, I like, and the Dane's like, where's Leo now? Huh? Where's Leo now?
Yeah.
And someone goes, hey, I found the body.
It's over here.
And it's one of my favorite moments because as the audience, you are like,
you're like, what?
Mind fucked. Right.
Yeah.
A body that looks exactly like John Turturro and is wearing the clothes he was wearing. Is shot through the face, lying in the woods in the same spot. And you're like, what is going on?
Like, how is this possible? Was that earlier thing a dream and he actually killed him? Like, you don't know. Turns out, as he arrives home and he's shaking as he pours himself a whiskey, he arrives and Bernie's at his house.
At his house again.
Which is so good.
First off, he came back so earnest when he said, God bless you. You've saved my life.
Yeah, I owe you forever.
I understand that this means you're a human. You spared my life because you're a human
being.
And
the only thing Tom asked of him is never come back, and he's back.
And not only that, but you know why he came back? He says, you know, I was thinking and I realized you would get in major trouble with Casper if he knew you didn't kill me.
Right.
So I figure if I stay in town, you pay me $5,000 a week just to keep that information quiet. If I leave town, I got nothing.
It's grifting. It's
and he goes,
betting.
But how can you do that after I spared your life? And he goes, what did I say in the woods? You hand me an angle, I got to play it. I'm a machine. That's what
I do. Did you notice the hat work also?
Well, I noticed that. Because he's such an outsider in so many ways, Bernie has a crazy weird hat that no one else in the movie has had anything like.
But it's like he's got hat in hand, but he's taking the superior status.
Yeah. So imagine someone sparing your life and you use that to blackmail them for a small sum of money.
And Gabriel Byrne is just like
flabbergasted. I'm like,
but he's just
get
like,
the fuck out of here.
You fucking grifter.
Yeah,
you fucking
exactly.
But he has to, quote unquote, obey that rule, so he does. And
Vernon
doesn't know where he is. No one knows where he is. He still hasn't been there, but it's revealed that body is Mink's body.
Bernie explains. He says, well, how the fuck did that happen?
So Bernie murdered his own
friend and sometimes lover.
Sometimes lover.
He's a base and business partner. He was a bookie with him.
As grifty as you can get. And dressed him
up and
put him out in the woods. That's such a plan.
Well, what he says
is, I know that the Dane will want to find me.
Well, what he says is, when I got home, because Mink, they were like living together in the same apartment. Says when I got home and told him what happened, Mink was really upset. He didn't think it was a good plan. And he thought we would get caught. And he especially didn't like when I said, I'm going to blackmail you and stay in town.
Right.
So things got out of hand and I shot him. And then I thought, hey, I might as well have insurance. So I dressed him up in my clothes, shot him again through the face so you couldn't recognize him and put him in the woods. It's creepy as
hell. He saved Tom's life.
Right, but by being a fucking
monster.
By
being a monster.
Yeah. And I think he tells him that while smiling as a way to see, like, say also, see, I have the guts to kill someone and you don't, so don't fuck with me. So then what happens is, this is great, he leaves the room. He goes like, and I'll see you later, I'll be in touch. And we see, as you said, he uses the same trick Albert Finney uses, and it's clear to us that now he will kill Bernie.
Yeah.
He will not hesitate a second time.
Right.
So he grabs his pistol, takes off his shoes so he won't be heard, and like pads down the hall and jumps down the staircase so that he can like beat Bernie to the street.
But Bernie's already one step ahead.
Bernie's hiding in a closet and trips him.
And like, he trips him, and then he says, "You don't think I?"
And kicks him in the ribs a bunch, and is like, "You think I'm a fucking moron? Like, you'll never beat me at this."
Which makes like Bernie seriously, like, as a strategist, like,
as good
super
as Tommy.
Good. Yeah,
yeah.
That's twice he was like, "I made a fool out of you."
And then what's funny is it's very shortly thereafter that Lazar's men come
and beat the shit.
And they're
out
like,
of Tom.
"You still don't have the money?" Yeah. And you're not affiliated with Leo anymore? Yeah. All right, well, we got to beat the shit out of you. I know. Okay. And they beat the shit out of him. And they go like, "Sorry, Tommy." And he goes, "Hey, you're doing your job, man."
Yeah. Tom says, "Tell Lazar no hard feelings." And Lazar's messenger says, "Jesus, Tom, he knows."
Which is, I love this world where you're like, extreme violence is part of the punishment, but no one means anything by it.
No.
Reminds me of the Elvis Costello song, Watching the Detectives, this whole sequence.
It's just ethics.
Yeah. So we get to the climax scene where, and that's another thing. Yeah, Casper, in one of their many talks, I love, Casper is explaining, he says, "Why don't you just double cross the Dane?" And he goes, "Because of ethics." Like, he gives the same speech again. So he has these weird ethics.
Well, he's also playing to Casper's.
Yes.
Like, he's already made it very clear he thinks he's an ethical man.
Yeah.
Which is another placement for what we're saying about how Tommy is, he thinks of himself as a principled man. They really mean the same thing.
But his principle is, I can be amoral as long as the ends justify the means.
Right.
Tommy believes that his ends justify the means. So anyway, there's all this stuff with Drop, this big dumb guy that's used for comedic effect, but I want to skip ahead to the point where the climactic scene where things start to unravel is, he's walking down the street in the rain, Verna comes one more time and accuses him of having Bernie get killed, and he basically doesn't deny it, and she says, "Wow, I just really thought you did have a heart, but you obviously
you don't.
That's the end of their arc. Then he goes to Casper's office, where a bunch of complicated shit is going down with the mayor and the police force that we're not going to get into. But suffice to say that the tension in that room raises because Dane starts going, "I know he's lying to you. I don't care that there was a body there." And then he finds out Mink was killed. And he starts beating the shit out of Tommy, saying, "You killed Mink, and I'm going to beat you till you admit it." Tommy has already convinced Casper that he's not the kind of guy who would kill Mink. And he's made Casper suspicious of the Dane. And
who's his right hand man?
He recently said, "The Dane is going to come up with some flimsy excuse to kill me soon.
Which is completely concocted.
Yeah.
The Dane is totally loyal.
The Dane is completely loyal. But the Dane also loved Mink. He truly did.
So he used that one. He's a grifter.
But it's great because Tommy basically like makes eye contact with Casper and is like, "See, I was right." He wins the fight yet again without throwing a punch because Casper sits there for a long time thinking and basically decides, "I trust Tommy more than the Dane," picks up the shovel from the fireplace and beats the Dane to death with it.
Which is ultimately the same struggle of like, it's like,
when
Tommy
then,
is
and
Yaga.
And then he shoots him because he says, "You always put one in the brain."
Right, right. But like, Tommy's Iago. Like,
Tommy is Iago to the Vizier in this. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And
or
it's,
Worm Tongue.
Yeah, yeah. What is it? Joy de vivre?
Joy de vivre, yeah. J-O-I de vivre, jack-off instructions. okay, so, like Verna asks, what was our affair about? And he says, "Nothing to me. It was a way to straighten things out with Leo." Whew. Okay, so the final...
Giving her the hi-hat.
The final leg of his plan, which I think is so brilliant, is the first thing I want to talk about. In pedagogy, so we'll serpentine.
Yeah.
Is Now the last remaining domino that he has to defeat is Casper himself, right?
Right.
Everyone's betrayed, but Casper still has to die. Oh, and Bernie's on his back.
So he's got a he's a man with a plan.
So his final plan, the final action of his plan is he tells Bernie, meet me at my apartment at 4 a.m. for us to work this shit out. And he tells Casper, Bernie's going to be at my apartment at 4 a.m.
Because Casper knows that Bernie's alive after the Dane revealed it.
He arrives at 4:05 a.m. to see what the results were, which I love because
he just
it
takes
could
a
have
walk.
Been either.
Yeah.
Or both. They could have killed each other. Who knows? Or they could have both escaped each other.
And of course, Bernie, because Bernie is very smart, came early.
Bernie came, and he says, actually, what'd you think would happen if you were a bad man? And he said, I figured you'd kill him because I assumed you'd come early.
Yeah.
Because that's your nature.
Because Casper was trusting. Bernie is always not trusting.
Casper assumed he was going to a meeting at his friend's apartment. Yeah.
And he's like, you got my back.
Yeah.
You know, you helped me with the Dane.
So actually, Casper does have ethics in the sense that the people he trusts, he really trusts. And
just
that's
leave
why,
it out in the open.
That's why he can't survive in this world.
Yeah. And same problem with Leo. They don't like all the... And the Dane as well. They were like, I open my mouth and the whole world gets smart. You know, like it's just the idea of like, there's too many people talking. There's too many friends.
Yeah.
You just have a friend.
Yeah.
You don't need to have friends of friends.
Also, I don't recall, is it did Verna ever shoot someone or someone used her gun Mink used her gun
Mink
to kill
Mink used
Rod.
Her gun, I think.
So she never actually kills anyone. But
no.
So the
I don't believe so.
Final bit before the denouement is he says, okay, Bernie, now hand me that gun because I have no reason to want to kill you anymore.
Right.
Because Casper's dead.
And I'll take care of this.
I'll take care of the gun, wipe off the fingerprints.
And they killed each other.
And he goes like, how do I know you're not going to shoot me with that gun? And he goes, because the Dane wouldn't allow it. He's going to be the new head man. You know how he feels about
you. Even though
you.
He's dead, yeah.
Right. So, but that's to get him to hand him the gun. And then he goes, oh, you know what? I just remembered. The Dane is dead, so I have no reason to not kill you. And he does amazingly...
Just taps right back into that energy.
Like a light switch. Immediately again, full waterworks. I'm praying to you, look in your heart. And this is the moment where Tommy finally admits who he is to himself. What heart? Bullet to the face.
Yep.
Tommy has fallen apart
and
completely.
Then plants
he is nothing.
The gun back and make sure that it looks like they shot each other on this stairwell.
Tommy is only his hat at this point. Like, that's all he is what his hat represents.
And then the final scene is Albert Finney basically...
They all meet up at Bernie's funeral.
Yeah, and then Leo basically forgiving him and saying, I want you back.
Because I didn't realize you were doing this amazing double
agent
thing.
And the film ends on a shot that is right after Albert Finney walking away and Gabriel Byrne is like...
Well, Gabriel Byrne says,
no,
I'm done being
I'm
in
out
mafia.
Of here.
Yeah.
He's going to Atlantic City or something. I don't know. He's just gone. And then he puts his hat on.
Yep.
So that's a good...
pedagogy!
So what do hats mean?
Well, before that, because this will be a quick one and I wanted to serpentine, we just talked about... I think it's so beautiful that this is a man who is a master manipulator, but because it's just a straight-up compulsion, he is a bad gambler. And that doesn't go with being... Right. His whole life is led by not gambling, but he literally is addicted to gambling. And the movie, like the fates try to tell him, you will always fail if you gamble. You never win bets. You only win when you have everything in hand. Mm-hmm. Then I love that his final act is to leave it up to fate. The final stage of his plan is a gamble. And for the first time ever, he wins a bet. So it doesn't matter that Lazar's men beat the shit out of him. The real bet he won is that Bernie shot Casper. So I just love that because for a long time I couldn't figure out what to connect the gambling arc to.
Which is so, there's two things I want to mention about that, about the Coen brothers and where they're at in their career at this time and why that is such a salient character and point at this time. Two things. One, in the middle of writing this, they took a 2-week hiatus because they couldn't break it down. Like, they didn't know how to do, quote-unquote, a studio movie. And just apropos of nothing, 3-week break, and wrote Barton Fink. the next thing that we'll talk about in this podcast, which is a film about a writer with writer's block. The Coen brothers turned down a 1989 film that actually Burton directed. It's a little known superhero movie called Batman.
Oh, they were offered Batman?
And they turned it down because it would interfere with this film. So
wow.
They were these guys who now, like, after Raising Arizona, like, the world's their fucking oyster.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel a little bit about, like, the studio system giving them the hi-hat and forcing studio films down their throat. And then they finally agree to do one, but on their terms. And they so it's like Batman or Miller's Crossing, you know, those common
right.
two films. So they clearly have their sentiment. And then they can't even write that. And they have to break and
yeah.
make Barton think a film about someone who can't write. And then come back and finish
yeah.
Miller's Crossing and then shoot it. That's why it didn't come out in 1989. It came out in 1990 because they had a prolonged period of not knowing how to break the film right. down, even though it was already an adaptation.
Well,
to me, Gabriel Byrne is basically their plight in terms of like, I'm a principled man but I also am a man with a plan. I want to succeed on my own terms, but I do have wants and desires that are going to interfere with that.
I think we'll talk even more about that in Barton Fink, because that's like the
yeah.
The
but I just think that
tensions
that
there.
They're like tight at the hip for me.
They're kind of twin films because they were thought of in the similar time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So as far as hats, because the cover of this is a hat. The first shot of it is a fedora blowing away mm-hmm. down the road away from mm-hmm. camera. And there are enough shots of hats and mentions of hats that they always, I've seen this movie with dumb people and they go, I think the hats meant something. Like, so, you know, it's there.
Oh, no, I said that.
Well, no, there's many interpretations to the hats.
I'm the dumb guy.
One is definitely it's your membership in the club or it's your status in the club. Because
right. it means status.
When we start with Tommy and he's down in the dumps in the beginning of the movie, the reason, not the reason, but at the same time, his hat got won in the poker game he lost last night. So his first little mini quest we see him do is to try and get his hat back. And it turns out Verna took it. And that's the first time that's the first excuse he has to go to his apartment and have sex with her. But at the same time, the symbolism is clear. He was he was a principled man who was a totally company man and had a totally clear conscience as far as I've done everything right by Leo. And then Verna took his hat. Like Verna mm-hmm. makes him feel that he's compromised his status within
yeah.
the trueness of his identity as a gangster.
And Casper getting the hi-hat all the time means that your hat is higher than mine and it doesn't deserve to be.
And Casper, very pointedly, is bald and doesn't wear a hat.
Yeah.
So he's like almost ashamed by like, because he has this, he's definitely overcompensating all the time. That's
Finney also doesn't wear a hat. I think that's something
maybe
bosses.
They're so powerful they don't
yeah.
have to.
Yeah.
And, of course, Tommy's hat is the one that is the symbolic one almost 95% of the time.
And there's Tom has a line. Verna says, what you chewing over? Tom says, dream I had once. I was walking in the woods. Don't know why. Wind came up and blew me hat off.
Yeah.
It's just like, and then she says, and you chased it, right? You ran and ran and finally caught up to it and picked it up.
But then you picked it up and it turned
out. But
it
wasn't a hat anymore and you changed it into something else, something wonderful.
Yeah.
He's like, nah, it stayed a hat. And no, I didn't chase it. Nothing more foolish than a man chasing his hat, which is what he is doing
okay.
the entire movie.
So we have the same brain because I think that's the beginning and end and the key to the hats. Yeah. Especially when you can, here's how I think they deployed it, which is great. The opening shot is a hat blowing away.
Mm-hmm.
And you're keyed to wonder, why was that your opening shot? When he describes that dream, you realize the opening shot was a shot from that dream.
Yeah.
Like, literally, it's not a diegetic shot from the action of the film. That opening shot was a reference to the dream he's now describing.
And it's on the camera's on the ground. It's
right.
looking like the leaves wisp across. And then, if I remember correctly, it looks up at the, like, a vanishing point shot of trees.
That's under the opening credits. That's a different shot.
Oh, okay.
But I want to talk about that next.
But it's all
but
the woods.
Just to wrap up the hat thing. So that keys you in to realize this dream is important. And then I think when you parse the dream, you're absolutely right. that the important point is he feels his identity is running away from him. And she says, well, a normal human being with a heart, anyone would. So you want it back, right? And of course he does, because we see through his actions that's all he wants. Mm-hmm. But another facet of this dead on the outside person is that
he thinks it's foolish.
That will never be admitted.
Yeah.
He says, yeah, there's nothing foolish than letting the world know you care about anything or trying to get something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because then maybe you won't be in an advantageous position to manipulate things. Like,
right.
And that's in the same scene where she says, a lie and no heart, Tommy, that's you all over. And she says, like, we're really bad people at one point. And he goes, like, you think so? And she goes, yeah, Tommy, we're both real heels. Like, yeah. Do you not see that? We're terrible.
Yeah. So I think the woods... So I think there's a way in which they... Like, I don't know if there's a symbolic nature to the woods. I did have a thought, though, which is that the shot is from the ground. So there's something morbid and, like, death-inviting about the shot of a hat being whisked away in the wind, kind of in, like, a Lawrence of Arabia...
But don't conflate the shots.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm just saying the fact that they both happen in the woods and his dream right. is about woods and he's losing his hat.
But I think an important point is, under the opening credits... That shot where you're dollying, but the camera's pointed straight up, that recurs in the John Turturro in the woods.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, not in the second sequence when Tommy thinks he's going to be killed.
Yeah. In other words, I think it's the point of view from a grave is what I'm trying to get at. I think that the reason that they put it on the ground is that there's something about looking up when you're thinking about status and hats, you know. Looking up towards the heavens and like wishing for a better lot than the one that you have.
Like it's a movie about people climbing up. So it's
in the woods and
from the ground towards the heavens. Yeah.
And at one point Casper actually says in his first scene, he's like, if we don't have ethics, what are we? We're just like animals in the jungle. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what this movie is kind of trying to say is that, we built ethics and we built these ideas of principles. In a way, it's a nihilistic film once again.
Well, and Turturro also says, you just made me realize, you know, I can't die in the woods like an animal.
Like an animal. Yeah.
So I think there might also be commentary on, which is a simple level, but it's true, is like, you think the animals are confined to the woods? Look at all these human animals.
Exactly.
Back in civilization.
And not only that, we are still animals just because we have a different...
Yeah.
Just because we have hats
we're just
does not make us any different from like our base influences. Things like love. Things
I mean,
like
they should reshoot this movie with just animals in fedoras as the characters.
It's like Babe Pig in the City style.
No.
So it would be a director's fucking dream to just work with only animals.
So you mentioned nihilism. That's something I highlighted for pedagogy. When I first saw this, I always thought it's just fun mafia movie and their goals were for it to be fun and tightly plotted and engaging and surprising, right? Now I'm wondering, is it their first nihilist, true, full-on nihilist film? And is it, it's like a stealth nihilism film? Because I do think most people would view it as a Batman. Meaning like at the end, you're just glad he lived. But if you pour through Tommy's story, it's inescapable that it's the story of realizing... that he's dead inside and nothing matters.
Well, we talked about this on Raising because we were comparing...
You think
like
Raising's nihilistic?
Yeah. I mean, like we were comparing Hudsucker and this as like... It's not entire... Like it's nihilistic in just the way they approach films.
Same as Burn After Reading.
Right.
Even though it's
there
funny,
are some films that, you could call nihilist, but like they are nihilistic filmmakers. And by the way, what I mean, and I think we mean by that, is that they believe that our perspective is building order out of chaos. There is no order in the world's chaos. Like that doesn't naturally occur. We, in our perception, like a Schrodinger's cat kind of observation, assume that there's an answer. And that is in Blood Simple. That's in Raising Arizona. Like circumstance gets the better of you sometimes. Or your plans come to fruition or not, but you're kind of powerless.
That's why I'm so excited.
You can be the best fucking
sure
person at the game and still lose.
That's why I'm so excited to get to Hudsucker, because it's so weirdly different than that.
Right.
But yeah, I agree that this is kind of a twin film to Burn After Reading, in the sense that it's saying, or I'm sorry, the Raising is, in the sense that they say, you know, nihilism can be funny too. Like, it doesn't, nihilism doesn't always have to bring depression. Right. Yeah.
It's sometimes it's tragic and sometimes it's laughable.
But I will say, when I watch this movie on the surface level, I feel it as a fun, hard-driving, constant twists and turns, whodunit, what's going to happen, oh my God, I'm surprised. When I think about it on the human level, it's a really sad movie. It's quite a tragedy.
Which is why I can't wait to get to Big Lebowski, because I feel the same way about that movie.
That it's a secret tragedy?
It's a secret, beautiful, hilarious tragedy.
Because Donnie dies?
No, in a way, yeah. Yeah, but let's save that for later. I'm just saying what you're dropping in terms of, like, it's the sleeper kind of, like, meditation on how you can still have all these wants and there's just not going to come out the way you want it, man.
Yeah.
And everything has to go through the wash. And sometimes when you mix your reds and your whites, you come out with pinks, you know,
like, yeah.
Sometimes your goals are antithetical to it. You are an animal because you have an unnecessary urge for self-destruction, apparently. Mm. And I think that that's what this movie is about, is that he is always taking his hat or putting it on, taking his hat off or putting it back on.
Nice. Yeah. Just watch it again, thinking about when he chooses to take his hat off. It's very important.
Literally anytime there's a hat in any frame,
it means something.
It means something.
Right. I mean, the first punch Albert Finney throws knocks his hat off. He's out of the game.
Right, he's out of the game. Everything has some kind of punctuation to it. Verna takes his hat.
I think it's howdy do that time.
Howdy do
what
that.
What do you think?
Oh, yeah.
Howdy do that. I got some loaded up, so.
You go.
I just think this is great. Michael R. Miller was their most frequent editing collaborator at the time. Mm-hmm. And they do say it's Miller's Crossings, just like, so it'd be like if we made a movie and it was called like Abe's Road. You know,
that's true.
Just Miller's Crossing. I don't know. Why not? And John Polito, who I cannot imagine not being Casper, was originally cast as the Dane. And it seems so perverse.
No,
that's wrong.
No.
And he campaigned to be Casper. And I think he steals
the
movie.
He's all the time.
There's amazing performances throughout. I think he's the strongest performance in the movie. Johnny Polito as Casper. I love it.
John Turturro based his performance on the film's cinematographer.
Barry, do you know anything about that movie?
What?
Oh, based it on the cinematographer.
Yeah, like his performance came from how, like, he was mimicking mannerisms. Like in his walk and his speech.
Well, Barry Sonnenfeld is constantly pleading for his life.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a little bit.
Speaking of Sonnenfeld, this is actually the last one he did cinematography for. So brace yourselves, people. It's Deacon's time, baby.
Yeah, next episode, just assume that Abe is constantly erect.
You're gonna start having to get used to hearing the words Roger Deakins.
Yeah, because he's my favorite filmmaker.
And mine, yeah. Steve Buscemi was cast as Mink LaRue because he could speak faster than anyone else they auditioned.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fucking
And that's amazing because is this Buscemi's first Cohen role?
Yeah.
I think so. Yes.
Yeah.
And so I'm so happy that just his speed of talking got him on this team because, as we know, he will become one of the MVPs of the Coen.
Oh, yeah. He's like in the stable.
So this is the beginning of a very bright collaboration.
I think this, even though, and once again, budget $14 million, box office $5 million. What a movie in terms of the box office failing and just jump-starting so many careers.
It's their first with Totoro. Well, she was in Raising.
Yeah, that's true. But I love, it's just keeping tabs on all the people who are... Holly Hunter isn't in this, but...
Yeah.
You know.
So Tommy checks out McDormand's butt very obviously when she
walks
through
true.
The room.
That's true. She's the secretary of the mayor,
yeah.
I believe.
The line, Jesus, Tom, is said 8 times, leading to a theory that maybe there's
That's
a Jesus
weird.
Parallel, like there's some he's supposed to be Jesus, but I don't get anything out of that when I try to connect the dots.
No, I don't get, because there's no forgiveness in him.
Yeah.
he's a rage monster when it comes down to it.
Oh, by the way, well, I just want to say someone asked, a couple people have asked if we're covering Crime Wave. I don't think so.
We're not going to cover Crime Wave.
Same deal as like Suburbicon, right? I don't need to cover that.
No, we want, they penned and directed.
That's the deal.
17.
The brothers have high standards. Oh, the...
we might capture it on frame rate.
The version of Danny Boy in the epic Tommy Gun sequence was recorded from scratch for the film because it doesn't time out the way the traditional song actually does. It's timed to fit the fight sequence and make it super epic.
Because it plays, even though it's, he jumps out of the record player. Like the room with the record player, it still plays.
This is great.
Beautiful.
In the original draft, on the front page, they did what screenwriters do sometimes. They had a bunch of suggested actors for each role. So you want to hear some?
Yeah.
Tom Reagan, Tommy. Willem Dafoe. I'm taking a second to imagine each one, yeah.
Right.
Andy Garcia. Yeah. Elias Koteas, I don't know. Dylan McDermott. Tom Sizemore. That would have ruined the movie, in my opinion.
Sizemore would be a great Dane, though.
But a good Dane, but not a good Tommy.
Yeah.
Verna, Linda Florentino, Marcy Gay Harden.
Well, that's
Laura Sametz. Don't know.
Well, Marcy Gay Harden.
Well, I know Marcy Gay Harden. Yeah. She made it. Bernie Birnbaum, let's see. Maybe I'm boring us. Okay, I'm gonna skip to, I'm gonna just find famous people. Oh, Ian Holm might have been Leo.
Oh,
Bilbo Baggins himself as Leo.
Oh, that would be cool.
He could have been a good Leo.
You can't replace
Finny.
Oh,
my God, dude.
But Ian Holm kills it.
I'm sorry, but actually, as much as I love Albert Finney, I could replace him with one on this list. So the next one, John Mahoney. Decent option.
Yeah, playing Faulkner. And
he'll be in Barton Fink next. But they considered Richard Jenkins. Richard Jenkins is a strong Leo.
Richard Jenkins.
Yeah.
Oof.
Ooh.
I got to be wrong about this. Burn After Reading was the first film that
Jenkins is in for them?
Yeah.
I think it may be.
That is.
We'll correct ourselves in another episode wrong.
Yeah, if we're wrong, or just point it out and then.
Is he in Lady Killers? No, that's Simmons, J.K. Simmons.
Yeah, that's J.K. Simmons. Because that is a match made in fucking heaven.
Yeah, totally. Jenkins should be in more Coens. Eddie Dane, Kevin Spacey. Don't need it.
I could kind of see it, but no.
And also, side note, Eddie Dane's original name in the script.
I mean, because Kevin Spacey was good in L.A. Confidential as that kind of, like, wise guy.
But I like. That he ended up being like a wall of of cold.
It doesn't feel Coen enough.
Also, Eddie Dane was originally named Blue Point in the script. Don't know why.
Well, that's
so. Of their original choices, only Marcia Gay Harden and John Turturro got the people they were going for.
Yeah, they were going for.
Fun fact that I noticed and asked you about: it's really hard, maybe impossible, to tell what city this is supposed to be taking place in.
It's supposed to be New York.
You think it's New York?
Yeah, because I think that the woods are like Albany country, you know, and like the downtown.
I see.
But they never explicitly say it.
IMDb points out that one of the only clues you could take is when he says we should pack up and leave, she says, where would we go, Vern? Or where would we go, Vern? Niagara Falls, which means they're probably in New York State, so it's probably New York
North
City.
East, yeah.
Yeah. Well, writing the screenplay, the brothers tentatively titled the film Big Head, which was their nickname for Tommy in the movie.
Yeah.
The first image they conceived of was that of a black hat coming to rest in a forest clearing, and then a guy with a massive head trying to cram into it. No, that's not what it
just
says.
Just a big head.
Then a gust of wind lifts it into the air, sending it flying. And what's funny to me is they mention every time they talk about this movie, yeah, that image came to us, and we knew we were going to make this movie. I don't get that connection.
I get it.
It's amazing. Good. I guess that's all that's important. Because it's nuts that they're like,
I can't explain it.
Hey, brother. Yes, brother. Filmmaking brother. Hey, brother.
By the way, they're touching their peens together.
Yeah.
Right?
Hey, brother.
This moment.
Yes, filmmaking brother. What about a hat? You mean blowing through trees?
Through leaves?
That's your movie.
That's your movie. Yes. We'll call it Something crossing.
Exactly.
Who's editing for us again?
Shitheads Crossing.
Big Heads Crossing.
So this has been our review of Shitheads Crossing. We'll see you next time for Barton Fink.
Barton Fink. Barton Fink. Barton Fink.
This has been a Small Beans endeavor. We're a bunch of pals who make podcasts, sketches, music, web series, and movies. The Beans always have new ideas percolating, so make sure to check us out at patreon.com/smallbeans. That's patreon.com/smallbeans, where you can browse all of our current and past content, see what we've got planned in the future, and learn how your support can help the Small Beans grow into huge, giant monster beans. If you enjoyed this content module, please like, rate, subscribe, or tell a friend about us. We love you!